Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Our first item today is about artificial intelligence. It may get better at personalized roles, and we're going to examine that in the following story. Let's say that you wake up in the middle of the night and it's cold, and you say, "Hey, Google, what's the temperature in zone 2? And you say into the darkness, waiting for that disembodied voice to respond, and then it responds, "The temperature in zone 2 is 52 degrees. And you say, "Set the heat to 68. And then you ask the gods of artificial intelligence to turn on the light. Well, many of us already live with artificial intelligence, an array of unseen algorithms that control our interconnected devices, from smartphones to security cameras and cars. And they heat the seats even before you stepped out of the house on a frigid morning. But while we've seen the AI sun, we have yet to truly shine. Researchers liken the current state of the technology to cell phones of the 1990s to the development of artificial intelligence thus far. It's useful, but crude and cumbersome. They're working on distilling the largest, most powerful machine learning models into lightweight software that can run, as they say, on the edge, meaning small devices such as kitchen appliances or even wearables. Our lives may gradually be interwoven with the brilliant threads of artificial intelligence. Our interactions with the technology will become increasingly personalized. Chatbots, for example, can be clumsy and frustrating today, but they will eventually become truly conversational, learning our habits and personalities, and even developing personalities of their own. But don't worry, the fever dreams of super intelligent machines, they're taking over, like HAL in the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, will remain science fiction for a long time to come. Consciousness, self-awareness, and free will in machines are far beyond the capabilities of science today. Privacy remains an issue because artificial intelligence requires data to learn patterns and to make decisions. But researchers are developing methods to use our data without actually seeing it. The so-called federated learning, for example, or to encrypt in ways that currently can't be hacked. Our homes and our cars will increasingly be watched over by artificial intelligence cameras and sensors. Some security cameras today use AI-enabled facial recognition software. They use it to identify frequent visitors and to detect strangers. But soon, networks of overlapping cameras and sensors will create a mesh of ambient intelligence that will be available to monitor us all of the time, if we want it. Ambient intelligence could recognize changes in behavior and prove a boon to older adults and their families. We're going to wait for these developments but they certainly suggest an interesting and new life for us. A lot of you are going to be very interested in this next topic. I call it the innovation of the week. A New Zealand startup company wants to replace copper cables with long-range wireless electricity. This from an article recently appeared in Popular Mechanics magazine. Picture the street outside your home and now erase the power lines. That's the wireless future of energy that a company called Imrod is hoping to bring following a utility-scale case study later this year. The system involves microwave energy transmitting across a series of intervening poles. The poles will have broad square receivers that catch and then relay the waves. And at the other end, there will be a rectifying antenna, or a rectenna, which will receive the microwaves and safely convert them into electricity. The company says radiation isn't a concern because the beam is tight and focused, unlike a cell phone signal. Tiny lasers even monitor the rectennas to sense any obstructions between the relay points, such as a bird or a tree. How about that? I'm anxious to see how this works out, aren't you? Now it's time for some health and science news. And first of all, the mystery molecule behind cold tooth pain. Researchers have finally figured out why exposing a damaged tooth to something cold, let's say a bite of ice cream or a sip of ice water, causes such piercing agony. While it's long been known that this pain is the result of damage to the outer layer of the tooth, it was a mystery exactly how the message was transmitted to the nerves inside. The answer, according to a recent article in the New York Times, is the protein TRPC5. And this protein is found in cells that are called odontoblasts. They make up the dentine shell just under the enamel. When exposed to cold, TRPC5 opens up to form a channel, letting ions flow across the cell's membrane. And this ion messaging channel exists throughout the body. When your eyes start to feel cold and dry on a chilly winter's day, that's because an ion channel has been activated in the cornea. Well, researchers at the Friedrich Alexander University in Germany wondered if TRPC5 could also be at play in tooth pain. And so together with colleagues, they engineered some mice without the ion channel and watched how they reacted to tooth damage. Sure enough, the rodents behaved as if nothing was wrong. And interestingly, one substance that prevents the protein from opening an ion channel is eugenol. In case that's unfamiliar to you, That's the active ingredient in the oil of cloves, a traditional toothache remedy, often dismissed as the stuff of old wives' tales. But you see, maybe the old cures are still good. And then, let's look at an astronaut's shrunken heart. If you spend a long time in space or in water, your heart will likely get smaller. That's the conclusion of a new study examining astronaut Scott Kelly. He lived on the International Space Station for almost a year, from 2015 to 2016. And also athlete Benoit Lecomte, who spent 159 days swimming across the Pacific Ocean in 2018. Researchers assumed that exercise done by both men, Kelly worked out for 2 hours a day, 6 days a week, on the International Space Station, would stop any shrinkage. But the data collected before and after their experiences showed that each suffered a loss of mass and of diameter in their heart's left ventricles. The most likely explanation is gravity, which is minimal in space and reduced in water. The body is used to pumping blood uphill against gravity in the upright position, said the author of this study, Benjamin Levine, University of Texas. And he says, neither man suffered any ill effects from a shrunken heart because it's a remarkably adaptive organ. It's spring, and no matter how hard I try, I cannot resist talking a little bit about baseball once in a while on our program. I wanted to tell you about two new books, especially one of them, that recognize the talents of Black players, including those of the Negro Leagues. Jackie Robinson may have been the first Black player to smash the color barrier and to play for the major leagues. But his is not the only story in the era of baseball's desegregation. The second less frequently discussed player to be invited into the majors was Larry Doby. He joined the Cleveland Indians mere months after Robinson historically signed with the Dodgers in 1947. With Doby's help, the Cleveland Indians would go on to win the World Series the next year, 1948. And the author of the book, Our Team, tells the thrilling story of the Indians' series win, the epic story of four men and the World Series that changed baseball. At this point, I have to pause for a moment and give you a little bit of historical context. At the end of World War II, in 1945, there was a World Series that year. Chicago fans would say there wasn't, but the Detroit Tigers beat the Chicago Cubs in the World Series in 1945. But the following year, in 1946 and 1947, the Yankees were at it again. And Cleveland then in 1948, is able to break the Yankee string of championships, World Series appearances. Cleveland won in 1948. At that time, the manager of the Yankees was Bucky Harris. Cast your minds back if you're an inveterate baseball fan. But at the time, George Steinbrenner was the general manager of the Yankees. And he had a good buddy who was named Manager of the Year in the Pacific Coast League. His name was Casey Stengel. And so in 1949, guess who was managing the Yankees and who wasn't? Well, Harris was gone and Casey Stengel was in. And Casey Stengel then and the Yankees were to win five more championships from 49 to 50 to 51 to 52. And eventually, Cleveland makes a reappearance in the World Series in 1954. And you all remember that World Series? That's when Willie Mays made the catch off of Cleveland outfielder Vic Wirtz's hit. Well, Wirtz had been with the Tigers. He was with the Tigers when, in my middle teens, I was bat boy, ball boy, and clubhouse boy for visiting teams at Briggs Stadium in Detroit. I was there in 1948. That was my first year. That's the year that Cleveland broke the Yankee string. And you should have heard how the Yankees crabbed about that the following year, saying that Cleveland had stolen their World Series money, and their wives were extremely annoyed because they had fur coats and new cars planned for, and they didn't get their World Series cut. Well, I tell you all that because I spent a lot of time as bat boy, ball boy, and clubhouse boy working in the clubhouse before games, and obviously also in the dugout. And during that time, baseball was becoming desegregated, and I was there when Larry Doby was there. And in this book, Our Team, the majority of it builds up to the historic win in 1948 with a discussion of Bill Veeck's dedication to jazzing up baseball viewing experience for people. Now, I wasn't able to meet Bill Veeck, but the book also talks about Bob Feller and his extracurricular mogul ambitions. Bob Feller was the best right-handed pitcher of his day, and at the end of the season would get together a group of players and they'd go barnstorming after the season. And this brought in quite a bit of money, and Feller was becoming quite wealthy in those dollars at that time. And so he incorporated himself as Robert Feller or Bob Feller, Inc., I-N-C. A lot of people don't know what Bob Feller's nickname was among the ball players. See, all the players, or most of them, have nicknames. Some of them I can't say here over the radio, but Bob Feller's nickname was Inky because he had incorporated himself. And I have other Bob Feller stories to tell you that maybe some other time. Larry Doby, the book points out, had feelings of isolation as the only black player on an otherwise white team. And this is something that I observed right away, because I grew up in a high school in which I was the minority, and my black friends were the majority, and we never had any interracial strife at that high school. And so when I saw the way the white players on his own team treated Larry Doby, I was very much surprised. And I noticed the way that they ignored him or didn't even congratulate him when he did something that was worthy of acclaim. And then a rookie came onto the team, and his name was Al Rosen. He went on to later become a home run hitter and a star. But in these earlier years, in the late 1940s, Al Rosen, a Jewish man, was the only person on that team that I saw that paid any attention to Larry Doby. And so when I saw that this book had been published and this was one of the subjects treated, I couldn't resist telling you about my experience. And finally, in the book, there is also coverage of Satchel Paige's disappointment that his talent didn't seem to be enough to overcome racial stereotypes of the day and earn him a place in the major leagues before he was past his prime. But I was there in the clubhouse the day that Satchel Paige arrived in Detroit to play with the Cleveland Indians, and saw him for several years. He was indeed an entertaining person, and he could still get people out. Joe DiMaggio said that Satchel Paige was the most difficult pitcher in the league for him to hit. And so I just wanted to draw this book to your attention because it's masterfully written and it's edge of your seat good. Our team is perfect for diehard baseball fans and for casual readers alike. And there's also a picture on this page of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly of April the 12th, where I'm reading this book review. There's a picture of one of the players in the Negro League. His name was Ron Teasley. He played in the Negro Leagues, and he's preparing to throw out a ceremonial first pitch at a charity baseball game in Hamtramck, Michigan, at Hamtramck Stadium in 2019. Ron Teasley went to my high school, Northwestern High School in Detroit, and was one of a large number of athletes who went on to become famous. I'm going to bring our program to an end today by telling you why barns are red. It's because of stardust. Red paint was once cheaper than other colors because its color came from iron, an element that's plentiful in the Earth's crust and was forged in the hearts of the stars. When iron is exposed to oxygen, it forms iron oxide. The redness of bricks comes from iron oxide, and so does the redness of the rust farmers once mixed with linseed oil to protect their barns' wood. One way or another, red barns have always owed their color to this cosmic compound. And now it looks like we're at the end of today's program. Thank you so very much for tuning in. And we want you to tune in again to next week's program. be sure that you dial 101.5 FM about this time, and I'll be waiting for you. Please remember that we work for you, and we want to give you a good show. We hope that you're amused, that you're enlightened from time to time, and we can help you keep up with the news. And so, with that said, you all take care out there now. It's a dangerous time of our country with the pandemic. So I don't want to lose any of my audience. You take care of yourself. That will help to take care of others too. And so this is going to be all for today. And I'm going down the road again to look for a variety of items that are appropriate for a little of this, a little of that. Willie, take us down the road again.